Hello and welcome to the RI Science Podcast. This is the latest episode of our mini-series where we interview PhD students to find out more about what they research and how they ended up doing a PhD in the first place. I'm Charlotte Collingwood, and when I'm not working on my own PhD in computational neuroscience, I'm an intern with the digital team at the RI. I've managed to convince five of my friends to join me in the studio to tell me more about what they do as PhD students. Please do leave this episode a rating and a review to let us know what you think and help more people discover the podcast. In today's episode, we're discussing computational psychiatry. Would you like to introduce yourself?
Yes, hello everyone. I am Sophie. I am a second year PhD student studying computational psychiatry at Oxford. And I also happen to be Charlotte's housemate.
And I'm very thankful for you being here. So tell me, Sophie, what is computational psychiatry?
So computational psychiatry is about applying a computational models to explain the mechanism driving anxiety, depression symptoms.
What are computational models?
So computational models are something that describes, describes the way the brain completes its cognitive functions, and it's usually described in mathematical language. And to simulate this model, you run it in a computer.
Okay, and how do you go from maths to anxiety? Like, that feels like such a big leap.
So the basic philosophy behind that is our brain is constantly doing computation, which is when where the math part comes in, where the brain computes a value, a probability, and they convert that into an action, which is what we observe. When you see the behaviors is where we say this, the symptom level part of depression, anxiety.
You're taking maths terms and trying to model what the brain is doing.
Yes.
So what question are you trying to answer? What maths are you modeling?
So the process that I'm interested in is how people adapt to uncertainties in the environment. And the way that we adapt to changes in the environment depends on if the changes is meaningful or is completely just randomness. And the way that we are modeling it is by looking at this term called a learning rate, which is how much you learn from the more recent data points that you just observed.
Okay, and how do you test that? Like, how do you collect data on people's learning rates?
So the data that we are collecting right now includes behavioral data, which means we design experiments where we manipulate different environmental uncertainties and we observe people's actions. And from there, we try to infer their learning rate through our model. And we also collect data from people's pupil dilations. And in the future, we also hope to run a study where we give people a medication that will changes how they adapt to changes in the environment.
So why is the ability to change in the environment so important to anxiety and depression?
So that's a great question. So first of all, we think how you learn the key statistic about environment when the environment is changing is sort of a fundamental part of cognition. So imagine that, so first of all, our environment doesn't just like spit out all these magic like numbers. Like let's say, oh, everyone pay attention, the real pricing of this potato is actually 5 pounds. It's not the 6 pounds that's being selling at Tesco. So it's actually your job to figure out it's 5 pounds to know which vegetable to buy on that day to make the most sense for your budget.
Okay.
So imagine that you simply do not have the ability to figure out it's actually 5 pounds when the potato price changes from 8 pounds to 2 pounds to whatever how much the potato is gonna be. That's gonna change how you make a decision.
Mm-hmm.
And these are the reasons that we believe why learning the true environment statistics under when environment is changing is such a fundamental part of cognition. And it's also because it gives rise to the more higher order stuff like decision making. So this is the first part of our motivation. The second part is because the hallmark of depression anxiety is this thing called intolerance of uncertainty. So this is something, this is a symptom that we observe among many patients. It's quite debilitating. And we believe intolerance of uncertainty has something to do with how we adapt and how we differentiate different types of uncertainties. And that's why we are studying it.
And do you think that through these models, we have the ability to change depression and anxiety? Could you cure it with what you're studying?
I don't think we can cure it. It's surely our hope to cure it. But But for us right now, computational modeling is a tool to understand, to uncover the mechanisms, the thing that's hidden from us that we can't simply observe with our bare eyes. And we do have hopes that with the medication that we're giving them, we can sort of change it. We can help people to be more, to adapt to uncertainties more optimally.
So obviously this is really important work that you're doing, and you could help so many people's lives. But what does that actually look like in the lab? Like, how are you going from maths to computers to anxiety to medication? That's such a wide range of things.
Yeah, that's. Thank you for the question. That's actually a really great question. Loads of people ask me, what do you do in the lab? Well, we don't have a microscope to look through things. Like I just described, our tools are computational. So loads of our work is actually done on a computer, where a day will look like, I will collect some data either online or in lab. I'm working on the in lab part. And then with the data, we run some basic analyses to make sure that we have a basic understanding of how the participants behave in the experiment. And from there, we try to find, we will hypothesize about why people generate the behaviors that they generate within the scope of experiments. And we try to frame that with mathematical languages. And then we convert the model into computer codes. And we will run some plots to make sure that we did not make any bugs and our model actually makes sense.
So that sounds quite stressful, doing all of these steps of like work and just hoping at the end of the day that your model is actually right. But I do think having that kind of stress is part of doing a PhD. So did you always know that a PhD was something you wanted to do?
No, I did not know that. For me, picking this PhD is a bit like, it's not like love at first sight. It's more like I sampled a bunch of different careers and decided PhD is better. It's very much like the scrolling process on a dating app. So... Which is true. You can't always, you know, be right the first time. I sort of have a list of different things I want to do. And throughout the years of my undergrad career, I sort of try out different things. Mm-hmm. And then I realized I quite love science. And a PhD is a fabulous way to get my mind sort of trained. And that's just what I want to do. And that's why I pick a PhD.
Okay. And so then how did you translate this wanting to do a PhD in science to wanting to do a PhD in computational psychiatry? It feels like such a niche subject. How do you get into it?
It's definitely niche. It's also quite new. So when I was doing my undergrad, I work in this lab that does stuff on computational cognitive science, and the lab's aim is to transfer what we know about human learning to machine learning. And I quite enjoy the process of using these computational tools to discover something that usually the more traditional psychological methods cannot discover. But at the same time, the experience also made me realize I hate computers. They are great tools. Don't get me wrong. They're great tools. They don't ever get tired and they don't make mistakes. But they're also quite boring. Like I'm just not very interested in devoting my career into improving computers. Mm-hmm. And that was also around the time when I see loads of my friends struggling with uni life. I mean, we were all 18, we just left home, we were trying to figure out how to budget, how to do our laundry, at the same time, like doing really well at school. And I just see all of my, loads of my friends actually struggling and self-medicating. And that's when I sort of have the idea of what if I use the tools I have, which is this sort of wonderful tool that I quite love, to study depression, anxiety, which seemingly to be all around me at the time. Mm-hmm. And that's why when I graduated college, I applied to UCL, which has a center in computational psychiatry. And that's also where I did my thesis. And that's sort of how I got into the computational psychiatry research.
So that's quite a journey to get into psychiatry from computers. Do you have any advice for younger students who might be considering a PhD in the future?
For PhD in general or?
Either.
Ah, I see. I would say PhD is at the end of the day, is about what you're doing and who you're doing with. So it's very important to figure out if the topic is actually something that you want to study. Mm-hmm. And to be honest, it's quite easy to figure out once you have a bunch of challenges, a series of challenges, and you're still sticking with it, you know, you quite love the subject. Mm-hmm. And the who you're studying with is also a key question. Like, it's not just about your supervisor, but also about your colleagues, students who are studying the subject with you. You just have to ask yourself, do you like to hang out with these people? Do you like these people? And you just have to go from there.
That sounds like great advice. I could probably take myself some time. I really appreciate you coming in. I feel like I've learned a lot about your PhD, which I probably should have known considering I live with you. And yes, I didn't. To finish it all off, I'm going to ask you the question that I know you're going to hate me for asking. But what is your one favorite fact that you've learned during your PhD?
I've learned that Einstein's brain actually has more glial cells than average human beings, which means his brain is better. His brain's regions is better at talking to each other. That could be the reason that he is a genius.
Well, there you have it. Einstein's brain is the reason he was a genius.
Thank you, Charlotte. Have a good day.
Bye.
Bye.
That's it for this episode. Thanks again to Sophie Xiong for coming in to talk to me. Please leave us a rating and a review to let us know what you thought and help more people discover the podcast. And if you want more science content, head to rigv.org for talks, live streams, blogs, and even more.